Welcome to the Mama Bear Dares podcast. I'm Tessie.
And I'm Leslie.
And we are sisters-in-law. We started this podcast because we just felt like in this world, in this country, women just don't have the voice that we think they deserve, right? And it's not the women splashed all over magazines. It's the moms that you sit next to at the PTA and watch as women like Leslie do their PowerPoints up in front. It's the women that are silently creating these beautiful ripples of love and compassion in their families, in their communities, in their world. So we just wanted to give them a bigger platform. And you guys, you know what? We've only been doing this for, what, Leslie, like 5 months or so?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. The outpouring of support and love and encouragement proves that we are onto something. You guys recognize this too. It's your friends, it's your moms, it's your sisters, that you are just in awe of the way they move through the world. So we love doing it, and we hope you guys love listening. But thanks for coming along for another episode.
That's right. We're celebrating you. You are the mama bear that we are talking about. And today we are going to talk about another extraordinary woman. She's a mom. I would dare to say that she's a humanitarian. Her name is Taryn Tesfaye. And weird story. I met Taryn when I was in Ethiopia this summer. And I knew that even though I was on vacation and my family had basically said, like, stop working, no talking about the podcast, I just couldn't help it. I had to pull out the computer and interview her. Since becoming a mom, I've been really interested in just the cultural differences in motherhood. Here we are, Tessie, in the Midwest. I'm right. In Iowa. You're in Michigan. We're parenting one way, but a mom, say, in the Netherlands or in Taiwan, they love their kids with that same mama love, but they have different cultural forces at play. So this is fascinating, right?
It really is, but I just have to take a moment to just, I just love the idea. I can picture you in Ethiopia just enjoying a cup of coffee. Of course, you strike up this conversation with a random stranger, and then the stranger says something profound, and you're like, you know what? I need to record you. And
that's
somehow
basically what happened.
Somehow you encourage this stranger to say yes, and voila, today's podcast. I just
exactly.
love that about you. But, you know, I obviously listened to your interview, which you did such a phenomenal job, by the way.
Thank you.
And we have a tie to this country, right? We both mm-hmm. have children who were born in Ethiopia. But I really genuinely believe that even if you don't, listener, have a strong interest in this place in East Africa, you will still find this interview interesting because we're always interested in what motherhood looks like in different parts of the world. I don't think that's unique to you and I, Leslie. Don't you agree?
I totally agree. I think we're all influenced by not only the way that we were raised and our own circumstances and our race and our socioeconomic status, all of those things, but there's also these really strong cultural and geographical forces at play in the way that we parent.
Mm-hmm.
So before we jump into the interview, I just want to let listeners know that in the show notes, I'm going to link several books that I've read and really enjoyed that kind of look at mothering with the different styles and influences from different places. So in case that interests you, I'm going to link 4 titles that you can check out that kind of play along with this theme about mothering abroad, mothering other places in this world, and what that really means for the way that you parent. So check out the show notes, www.mamabeardarespodcast.com. They will be there. They're great books. So if you're looking for something to read, or if you're just interested kind of in this little voyeuristic nature of looking at parenting in different spots of the world, then I've got some great book recommendations for you.
And I just have to make a plug for our show notes. We say it every time, but Leslie actually spends a lot of time cultivating and poring over these show notes. This isn't just like some weird random ploy to like get more hits on our website. It really is to further the conversation. We like to include things that are interesting about the conversation. So sometimes even if we don't specifically mention an article or a book, we will include it in the show notes just to further the topic that we are talking about. So make sure you check those out really, truly. Because Leslie, I mean, you just go all in on those and I appreciate that.
It's so much fun and so much easier for me to like pore over my computer with like not actually having to talk or do anything. So it's like the introverts into a podcast. Like if you, so yeah, check out the show notes.
What you'll find in the books or in the conversations like what you had with Taryn is just that there are so many ways to parent. And, you know, we kind of reference this in our Bad Moms episode. We will link to that in the show notes. But really, you guys, we're all doing a great job. It might not look like your neighbor. You might parent completely different. But our kids can survive and thrive in various atmospheres. There's no right or wrong way. So take the pressure off, right? You're going to hear about how Taryn does it in the middle of Ethiopia, which is just so fascinating.
It is. Tessie, can you imagine? I mean, we are parenting, the two of us, we're parenting Ethiopian children, but can you imagine parenting in Ethiopia?
No. I mean, I feel like I just have to tell our listener that the last time we were there, which is actually this past November 2015, I got really sick there, and I'm only laughing because I don't want to cry, but I ate some salad that it didn't occur to me that it had been rinsed in the water there, which of course my system is not used to, and for 2 days was so sick. And you know me, I texted all of you and was like, I need you to pray for me right now, because we were all very concerned. And so as soon as I was listening to your interview with Taryn, I just was thinking, because she references being sick there a few times. Mm-hmm, and I'm like, but she did it so casually. And I thought, I didn't parent. I didn't put on clothes. I didn't do anything for 2 days when I was sick in Ethiopia. And she has a little guy, like a tiny baby. And I'm so interested in how that all goes down there. And that's why I think our listeners will really be fascinated by the whole thing.
Oh, absolutely. So listeners, if you're a bit of a dreamer and you wonder what it might be like to live and to mother in a completely different space and place in this world, or if you're just amazed by the courage that it must take to raise children in a developing nation, if you've done any traveling, if you've been sick someplace, you know, that doesn't guarantee great healthcare, or that doing something as simple as eating a salad that was washed in water, you know, can be really detrimental to your health, then you're going to love hearing from Taryn. This is a woman who went to Ethiopia on a church trip.
Yeah, she's American. I don't think we referenced that. She's American.
Oh my gosh, you're right. Yeah. She's American. She is an American who traveled to Ethiopia on a church trip. She fell in love with her Ethiopian interpreter, and now she literally lives in a mud hut in the middle of Addis. Yeah. So the premise alone of this interview is fascinating. Yes. And you're going to hear what it's like to be an American mother in Ethiopia. You'll hear about healthcare, about doing laundry, about kind of the slowed down way of life. And then stick around till the end, because Taryn gives us a look at one angle of the refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. There are about 750,000 refugees living in Ethiopia, which is already this small, impoverished country. Her story is just fascinating. Yeah. So let's get into it. All right. I am sitting here in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and my family is staying at the Wellspring Guest House. And as we arrived and got up and had breakfast this morning, we met a woman named Taryn, and she is from Seattle, and she was holding this adorable baby. And of course we struck up a conversation, and she is being so generous with me right now and taking some time on this Saturday evening to answer some questions for the Mama Bear Dares podcast. So Taryn, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So I was fascinated by, you know, just the brief story that you told this morning as we were all sitting around breakfast. You told us that you lived here, that you had married an Ethiopian man, and that you now live here with your young son, Ezekiel. So tell our listeners kind of how you got here.
Yeah, so I went to a church just north of Seattle in Everett, Washington, called the Journey Church. And we came on a mission trip to Ethiopia to meet with a church that we were partnered with. And my now husband was working at that church, and he was our translator and the administrator for that church. And that is kind of how I met him, and our story goes kind of crazy. I was there for 1 week, and he will tell you that he knew he was going to marry me the first moment that he saw me. But from that week, we just stayed in contact. And about 8 months later, I came back to Ethiopia to kind of see the culture, meet his family. Mm-hmm. And then he came to the U.S. 4 months after that to meet my family. And that's when we got engaged, 1 year after we met. And then 6 months later, he came back to the U.S. and we got married. 2 weeks after our wedding, we moved here to Ethiopia.
That is amazing. So he knew the first time he saw you. When do you think you thought, like, oh, this is the guy I want to marry?
Well, I was interested before I left Ethiopia, mm-hmm. but I think about a month to 2 months after I got back to the U.S., I knew that I would be back in Ethiopia and that I would be married to him.
That is amazing. And his name, pronounce his name for us.
Arega.
Arega. Yes. Beautiful. And that was how many years ago that you've been here?
I've lived here for 2.5 years. Okay. So we moved here November of 2013.
Okay. And how did your family and your friends react to you making this huge move across not just the country, but the world?
Yeah. I think, well, my mom, when I first told her, she said that she was expecting it.
Really?
Almost. Yeah, she told me that she knew one day that I would be in Africa. She just didn't know when, but when I told her, she realized that that was the time.
Oh my gosh, why? Like, had you showed sort of the sense of adventure as a kid, or had you said things like you wanted to do work here?
Well, I've always had a heart for Africa, and I've always wanted to come visit somewhere on this continent. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of friends who had adopted children from Ethiopia. My heart just grew bigger and bigger. And so I had always wanted to come and do work here. And my mom knew that eventually that I would be here because I was very independent growing up. And so she knew that I would go forward on my own at some point.
And you were telling me that it's not, your mom has been really supportive,
yes,
but that it's been hard, right? I mean, here's her baby, you know, across the world with her grandchild.
Yeah. And of course, we're not in luxury housing or anything here. We live in a traditional mud house. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's sometimes difficult for people to realize really what the living conditions are like until they come mm-hmm. visit us, that sometimes we're without electricity for, you know, up to a week at one point. We've been without water for a maximum of 3 weeks. Usually it's only a couple of days. No hot water, you know, it's our access to luxuries, such as those things, are limited.
But you can certainly see, we talk a lot about the mama bear inside all of us. And I'm sure, you know, before your mom probably thinking of you on the other side of the world in conditions that really none of us that are accustomed to the United mm-hmm. States can really even grasp. I'm sure that that's been a huge adjustment and sort of an interesting time for your family.
Yes, of course. They always check up on me to make sure that I'm doing well because my health has also been a little bit difficult since we've mm-hmm. been here. I've been sick on multiple occasions with some pretty rough stuff that you don't even see in the U.S. anymore. Yeah. And so, so of course they're always checking in on me, make sure that I'm doing well. And they always like to, you know, make sure that we have the stuff that we really need here.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. So you had said that you contracted typhoid, like, pretty much right away.
Yes. I've had typhoid now 4 times in the 2.5 years that I've been here. I had it the first week that I got here, and then again about 8 months after that. And then I was free from it for quite some time, for about a year and 3 months. I got it again. And then just a couple months after that, I had it a fourth time.
And what's healthcare like here? What do you do when you get typhoid?
Yeah, well,
an ear infection. I mean, what happens?
We've made pretty good friends with our local clinic.
Yeah.
I feel like we visit there monthly at least, but they know us pretty well. And we've grown to trust them.
Mm-hmm. And is the clinic staffed with a doctor, or is it what?
Yes. So there's a doctor on staff, 24 hours a day.
Okay.
And a nurse, and then a lab technician during the day. When it's something a little bit more, intense, if you need blood work, x-rays, ultrasounds, that kind of stuff, they send you to their hospital, which is, right down the road.
Okay. And that's here in Addis.
That's here in Addis. It's really close to our house. We really trust them, and they've given us great care. You know, my husband has seen them. I've seen them. My son has been there as well. So.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Is that typical throughout the country, just to kind of talk a little bit about healthcare in Ethiopia?
Yeah. In the major cities, I don't think healthcare is much of an issue. I think if you have something a little bit more intense, such as cancer or something, it's less able to be treated here. But with simple diseases such as parasites, bacteria, that kind of stuff, the local clinics are really well equipped to handle that.
Good. Did you give birth here?
I did give birth
here. Oh my gosh, we have to hear that story. Tell us what that was like.
Yeah, well, I gave birth at a hospital near the airport, so they're accustomed to foreigners being there. And my midwife is actually a foreigner herself.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, she's German, married to a previous president of Ethiopia.
You're kidding.
Yeah. And but I had great care from her throughout the entire pregnancy. And then, of course, you know, D-Day came around and it was, for me, it was a fine experience, but the last thing that I wanted was to have a C-section in Ethiopia, and so I was so keen on doing a natural birth, and that wasn't the way it was supposed to go. So after 17 hours of being in labor, my midwife told me that I didn't really have any other options.
Oh, wow.
And I ended up having to have C-section at the hospital there. But the surgeon was wonderful. They really, did a great job. And I healed really quickly. And so I was really thankful for that experience, even though it was probably my worst nightmare to have a C-section here.
And what was scary to you about that?
I think for me it was more the healing process afterwards. I've heard horror stories about, you know, people with C-sections and it not healing and infections and all this stuff. And so, of course, with the conditions here and some of the illnesses I've had in the past, I was concerned about how my body would heal and how I could handle that. Mm-hmm. But it turns out it went perfectly fine.
Good. What are those first few months like here in Ethiopia?
Yeah, the nice thing here in Ethiopia is that every woman is allowed 3 months maternity leave. Now, they do 1 month before your due date.
Okay.
But I was able to negotiate with my work to work up until I delivered. So I worked the day before I delivered. But so I had 3 months after my son was born to be at home and to be with him. And they're very caring here as well. And so even when I went back to work, I was given plenty of time to pump and that kind of stuff so that my son could have breast milk. And so they were all very caring and made sure that, you know, I was able to, they weren't keeping me at work late, that I was able to go home on time and be with my son.
And you mentioned before that you live in, you said it's called a compound, right? So tell us, you live in a traditional neighborhood, in a traditional home, and tell us about the compound, because this is sort of fascinating.
Yeah, so we live on my husband's family's compound. we each have separate housing, but they're all attached and very close. So, you know, we're 10 steps away from my mother-in-law's front door. So we have our own house, and then my husband's mother and brothers and sisters who aren't married also live there.
Okay.
And then one of the other married siblings lives on the compound.
Okay.
And one aunt lives there, and then one woman and her two boys also live there, and they've been there for, yeah, almost 12 years, so they're practically family
okay.
now.
Okay. Wow. So what is that like to live next door to your mother-in-law and, like, you know, all these, I would love to live next door to my mother-in-law. I'm not saying anything like that, but that's a really unique living situation.
Yeah, it's very unique. A lot of my husband's family doesn't speak English or very limited English. Mm-hmm. So there's, and my Amharic is unfortunately very raw. So, our communication is very limited at times, but of course we can communicate through some of the siblings and my husband. But they're fairly wonderful.
Yeah.
yeah, it's really nice. We all eat together, all of our meals. And yeah, so his family cooks for us, so I don't have to cook, which is kind of nice. And we get delicious traditional food. So I think for the most part, it's a really good relationship. But of course, when you live in such close quarters, differences in culture and differences in opinion, really, I think come up more often than they would in a traditional setting that
right.
we're used to
yeah.
in the U.S.
Just with that little separation of geography.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So is that, you know, throughout Addis, are there different compounds of different families? Like, is that a traditional sort of way to live?
I don't think it's necessarily traditional. I think families always live together until their children are married. So as the children get married, they move out normally to their own places. But especially if the family owns the land that they live on, they will build additional houses to accompany the extra family.
Okay, that's interesting. What are some of those cultural differences that you've found both challenging but also kind of enriching, would you say?
Yeah, I think with, especially, I notice a lot more after I've had my own child here. You notice just the small, minute differences in raising a child and what's important. Like for us, our son, probably the first 9 to 10 months of his life was very fussy. He always wanted to be moving. I mean, since day one, if you weren't carrying him around, he was screaming. He would never lay down. He always wanted to move. And when he couldn't do it on his own, it frustrated him. And so he was a very fussy child. And here, children don't cry, like babies. Right. You shouldn't let them cry. You should care for them immediately. The first sound out of their mouth, you should pick them up. And so I think with that, it made me almost feel like I wasn't maybe ready for this part of my life, or like I wasn't equipped to really handle my son. But we've also gone back to the U.S., to the States, and stayed with my family for some time. And when I was there, you really realize that it's just a cultural difference. You know, my family, they didn't cry out when he cried.
Right.
You know, it's just, he's a child, that's what he does. Whereas here, as soon as they cry, you know, they try to comfort them or tell you to comfort them. Or they have this word that they use, inane. And so, like, as soon as he would cry, they say this. And so it kind of makes you feel like, oh, I'm doing something wrong. But really, it's just part of the culture that I wasn't used to.
That is fascinating. And I can imagine as a new mom, when you really, you feel already like you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know? than to kind of have that added layer of like, oh gosh, I don't know what I'm doing, and no one else thinks I know what I'm doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Either.
Like they know.
That's interesting. And your son is 13 months now.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And he is adorable, toddling around. And I think you're right. Like, I've obviously just met you this morning, but I don't think he's stopped moving. Like, every time I've seen him,
he's always been moving. Yeah. Always going.
So, what are things that, or maybe are there things about mothering a baby that you've learned from the Ethiopian culture that you're like, oh yeah, this actually makes a lot of sense. Why don't people do that in America? You know, like, are there things like that?
Yeah, there's one interesting thing that they have here. There's an herb. It's called Dana Adam, but I don't know what it's called in English. But Dana Adam means the health of Adam. But it's just a small herb, and they use it in their coffee and tea. It has a really nice aroma, and I personally really enjoy it. But they also use it for when they're sick. If their stomach is bothering them, they will actually chew it and eat it, or again, use it in their coffee and tea. But here, when the child is small, they will boil it in a very small amount of water and give the water then to the child, and it works as like a cure for like colic type symptoms.
My goodness.
And so we never use that with our son, but I think if the next one is similar, we will be using some of the Dana Adam for that.
Yeah. Oh, that's fascinating. That's really good. Okay, so I wanted to ask you also about gender roles here. Are those different? Has that been difficult at all in your life here?
I think for me, it hasn't. I think my husband he's not necessarily a typical Habesha, we like to say. So he's very caring and doting on me, of course, but I've noticed some of it in the family. So men are not expected to really do much in the home.
Okay.
They are expected to work and kind of bring home the money and care for the family. But I've noticed even, you know, some of the family members, the men, they will come home and they don't do anything once they come home. It's if they want a glass of water, they call to their sister, their wife, their mother, whatever, to bring them a glass of water. Even if the mother is in the kitchen cooking up a storm, he still calls out to ask for the water and that kind of stuff. And so for me, that was a bit surprising because I think, you know, if they're busy cooking, maybe you can use your feet to go get the water if you're just sitting there watching television. But in this culture, it's normal. There's, you know, none of the sisters or anyone gets upset about it. Mm-hmm. It's just the normal cultural role for them. And so they're very used to it. But for me, of course, it's a bit surprising. I want to tell them to get up and do it themselves. But, you know, I keep my mouth shut.
Right.
But but my husband, I haven't really had to deal with it personally because my husband doesn't really share that mindset, really.
Did your husband attend university?
He did. He attended university here in Ethiopia, in the north of the country, at Gonder University.
And do you think that has shaped him a little bit as far as some of the more traditional rules? Does that, just as people tend to go to college and learn new things and learn new ways, does that come home then, do you think?
Yeah, I think it does. But also after he went to university, he worked in a different area than where his family lives. So he was living independently. And so I think it was more of him living independently that really brought about some of those views.
Okay.
Because traditionally, the child will live at home with them, with the family until they're married, and then that's the point that they move out, and then their wife basically takes over.
Right.
But because my husband was on his own for a couple of years, I think that really helped shape his view on those things.
So at what point did you transition from this idea of this man and this new country to like, I'm doing this, we're doing this, you know, was there a moment where, you know, cause that to a lot of people, I mean, that takes a lot of guts and gumption and just like a kind of a certainty, even though you're incredibly unsure of what lies ahead.
Yeah. I would say I don't know that I've gotten to that point of we're doing it. We're still making it. I think maybe that will come for me when we're out of the situation, when we've gone into, back to the U.S. and we're, you know, in a new way of life. And then when I look back on it, maybe I'll see it that way, but still I feel unsure so many times. Yeah. So,
do you wake up in the morning ever and just, I mean, what does it feel like to wake up in the morning in a mud house in the middle of Addis with your husband and child?
Yeah, that part I think has become fairly normal to me.
Okay.
Initially it was difficult. You know, you wake up and you realize, you know, you go to the bathroom and there's no running water, so what do you do? And there's so many different small things that you don't realize that you will have to deal with that kind of start to pile up on you. And, you know, it feels like the weight of the world is on your shoulders. But slowly, or as they say in Ethiopia, kes, like that starts to go away. But I can't say that there's one point where I've said, I'm in it and I'm doing this. It's been a very slow transition.
I appreciate just your honesty in that, because I mean, yeah, like life rarely comes with certainty, I guess.
Yeah.
But tell us about some of those things, you know, just like, okay, there's no running water or you might be without power. Like, what are some other things that you're finding here that is becoming normalized, but mm-hmm. that people back in Seattle or wherever would just be like, what? You know, what are some examples?
Yeah, I think running water was one of the bigger ones for me. You know, you can't always turn on the sink and have water. You can't, you know, always flush the toilet. You have to pour water down the mm-hmm. toilet, or, you know, you don't always have water coming through your water filter. So what do you do? So I think that was one of the harder ones for me. But then also electricity. You can't count on it. It can come and go as it pleases. And like I said, I think the longest we've gone without electricity is somewhere around a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, a week. How do you cook?
Yeah.
How do you store things in the fridge? Especially at that time, I was still breastfeeding, so I had frozen breast milk in the freezer.
Oh my
gosh.
And
I had to pour it down the sink, and I almost cried.
Of course you did. All the moms listening are just like, no.
Yes, I almost shed a tear at that point. But, so it's difficult because it can shut off at any moment in the middle of cooking and that kind of stuff. And, of course, they get used to it here, and they're prepared and
that. What do people cook on? Do you have, like...
Yeah, so in our house, we have a stove.
Okay.
So two of the burners are electric.
Okay.
And two of the burners are gas.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also use the traditional coal
okay.
to cook, especially when we're doing coffee, because that's the traditional way to do it. So we use coal often.
For that. Oh, my gosh. You're, like, the perfect person to appreciate the coffee here, being from Seattle. And
I love the coffee here. It's
what
normal.
A gift that must be. Yeah.
Yeah.
So talk to us more about water, because I know that's something that we're starting to hear a lot more about in the United States, of just, like, the lack of clean water and just the big, really big deal that that is. So what do you see around you here? And again, you're in Addis, so you're in a big city. That's...
Yeah, we're in a big city. We're in the capital city, so of course the biggest in Ethiopia. And so probably we have the most out of all the cities here. But, you know, we still go without water for a couple of days. We usually get it for about half a day, and then it's gone for 2 or 3 days.
And is that because... it runs out, like the sort. It just, there's so many people tapping.
No, I don't think because it runs out, but I think they specifically shut it off to conserve water because it's very limited here. Mm-hmm. And even a few months ago, they had announced that the water is very limited because mm-hmm. Ethiopia is currently going through a massive drought. Mm-hmm. And so they warned us, you will be without water for, you know, probably a week at a time.
Yeah.
So at least we got some warning about that, which isn't very usual here in Ethiopia. But
so can you buy, you said you have a filter in your home that you use.
Yeah, I have a water filter that we use for drinking water. Mm-hmm. But you'll also see here on many rooftops these big white tankers where, of course, you can store water. Mm-hmm. And then if you go to any compound, you will find large buckets of just water that mm-hmm. they fill up when it comes.
So rainwater.
Yeah, they use rainwater, but also when the water comes to the house from the city, they mm-hmm. will fill up these buckets so that they can use them, whether it's for laundry or showers or cooking, drinking.
And you were saying for drinking water, it's you leave it out, right?
Yeah, but so people who don't use filters, normally they fill like maybe a 20-liter container of water, and they let it set to kind of let anything like evaporate out of the water or to settle to the bottom, and then they can typically drink it. Even though I've been here 2.5 years, I still can't drink that water, so we have to have a filter at our house.
And what about boiled water? Do people?
Yeah, I can even drink boiled water.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then in rural areas, tell us a little bit, I guess, about the issues that people in more rural areas face.
Yeah, most, at least like at our house, we have a pipe coming to our house, mm-hmm. you know, that we can get water from. But in more countryside, really rural areas, they won't even have that. Sometimes it's just one for an entire village, mm-hmm. and they have to go to the water pump to collect water. So that can also be a huge burden on women, mm-hmm. Women and girls, because that is a woman's job to collect water. So even in a lot of the rural areas, it's mainly boys that are educated mm-hmm. because they can go to school, whereas maybe the girls have to stay home because they have to do the laundry that day or they have to go collect the water. So in the rural areas, it's definitely a big issue, especially now with the drought, especially in eastern Ethiopia. So the water issues play a huge role when it comes to like gender issues here. Mm-hmm.
What else about your day surprises you? Sometimes you're just like, oh my gosh, this is happening.
I think I'm still surprised that, you know, grown men, grown women, as I walk down the street, call out to me like I'm, you know, somehow very different or something. Mm-hmm. And they don't even know me, but as soon as they see me walking down the road, it's Ferengi or China, even though
like
I'm white, and they still call me China. Yeah. Yeah. So I think that still sometimes catches me off guard. Yeah. When it's children, it doesn't really catch me off guard as much. But when it's, you know, a 40-year-old man, right. Ferengi, like it still shocks me a bit mm-hmm. that I'm that surprising.
Yeah.
Here.
Are there many other Ferengis around, or
not where I live? I definitely live on the edge of the city. Mm-hmm. If you go just a couple of miles down the road, you hit Oromia region. You're outside of the city. So where I am, it's a very developing area, mm-hmm. But still very poor.
Okay.
Edge of the city, not many Ferengis there. Mm-hmm. If you go more towards the airport area, mm-hmm. there's a higher density of foreigners there, but it's, yeah.
Okay. So, any other parenting kind of styles or lifestyle with kids sort of thing that you've noticed here and as you envision maybe even your child getting older here, even though you're probably going to be coming back to the States, like what are some of the other differences that you've noticed?
Yeah, I think with my son, especially with how young he was, he started crawling when we were visiting family in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So, of course, when we come back here, you know, he wants to crawl everywhere. Uh-huh. But the dust, if you've ever been to Ethiopia, is incredible. It gets everywhere, and it's nearly impossible to clean, especially with how the houses are crafted, like the traditional houses. Not every seam is, you know, shut. Not everything is sealed off from the outside. So there's an incredible amount of dust in this country. And then when it's rainy season, there's an incredible amount of mud that's in this country. Mm-hmm. Especially where we live, you know, in traditional housing and stuff. And so when we came back, for me to put my son on the ground and have him crawl around and have dust and mud everywhere, all over his hands, which, of course, then he sticks right in his mouth and, you know, in my mouth, and and just his clothes getting completely ruined by the environment here. And I think that was something that... You know, I knew my son wanted to crawl. I knew he needed to room to run. But for me, it broke my heart a little bit every time I had to put him down, because I was so afraid of, is he going to get sick? Am I going to have typhoid again? You know, he's ruining his clothes, and, you know.
Well, I mean,
it's so, the baby clothes are incredibly expensive here, much more than they are in the U.S.
I wish I would have known you would be here. I would have totally brought you, like, a suitcase full.
Yeah, so it's just, it worried me a lot. Yeah. And then through time, you just kind of realize, this is what... my husband did when he was a baby. Yes. And look how he's flourishing. I'm much more sick than he is. And so you kind of, you slowly get over it and realize they'll survive, they'll make it. But it, I think for me, it was just really difficult to, yeah, for me to make that transition. My husband didn't care. My son didn't care. But it was hard for me to let that happen.
So just really practically speaking, though, I have two questions about that. Where do you do laundry? What is that like?
Yeah.
And then also giving him a bath. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not so simple, is it?
Yeah, it's not so simple. So, of course, when it's nice and warm outside, we can actually bathe him in cold water.
Okay.
We just set him in the sun in a nice plastic... round tub.
And, like, do you have to heat that water or anything before? Like,
no, if it's hot outside, we don't heat it.
Okay,
we
so just, the water's fine.
The water's fine. We have gotten, like, a shower head that makes water hot.
Okay. And is this but it filtered only, water?
No.
This okay.
is not filtered
so
water.
So if he puts that in his mouth, it's fine.
You just
okay.
pray that it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah. But, so we have a shower head, it only works when there's electricity, obviously. And sometimes the water pressure from the city is insane. Sometimes it is so intense that even just turning on the water a little bit, like, almost breaks the shower head.
Oh my God.
And other times it's not really enough that the water barely even comes out. So with the shower head, you have to have the right amount of pressure to get the water nice and warm. So it's not always hot. Sometimes it's... almost warm. And so, but you just kind of deal with it. But we also, if he needs a hot bath, you boil water on the stove and mix it with cold water until it's the right temperature.
Oh my gosh.
And then laundry, for the first year and a half that we were here, it was by hand. Like,
you were doing
in
it.
A bucket, just scrubbing. Yeah, me and my husband were doing it. It's normally a woman's job to do the laundry, but I'm so slow at doing it by hand that my husband has way more experience than me, that he was able to get through it a lot faster. So we always did it together, but it was never 50-50. He really took the brunt of that for the first year and a half. And then right before we had our son, I told my husband, we have to have a washer. Like, I cannot live without a washer. So we saved the money and we got a washer. But it's Very manual. You have to stand there and wait till the water's full to turn it off from the spigot. And then when it's done, you have to tell it to drain. And then when it's drained, you have to move it into another compartment where it spins.
Wow.
So it's still manual, but much less manual labor than before. But we also, we cloth diaper our son.
And I saw some hanging up there.
Yeah. So that was one of the requirements of before we have our son, we have to have a washer because I'm not washing diapers by hand.
So I just to be really kind of honest, like sometimes when I've traveled, like I see people doing laundry by hand. And though I understand at some level that, like, I do not want to be the person doing laundry by hand, or I, you know, I think I understand, like, how hard that is. But at the same time, I look at it and I'm like, that'd be kind of nice just to have, like, such a slow life that you do laundry. You're probably not with your husband, but you're with a friend or a group of women. So poke holes in that. Like, I know I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, I mean, well, I have to say the laundry part of it, my hands go raw when I wash laundry, so I don't particularly enjoy that portion of it. But I have to say, like, part of that culture, the how everything is so much slower, and you have to really, like, relax, especially in the U.S. We're so used to the moment we wake up, we have something to do and we have a schedule throughout the entire day. We're running around, whether it's work, shopping, you know, food, friends, church, you know, meetings, whatever we have to do. Our days are packed from start to finish. And I think that's one thing that I've really learned to appreciate. Of course, my days are like that before I moved here. They were crazy busy.
Right, because you were, tell us what you were doing before you were.
Yeah, I was working for the U.S. government doing fish disease research. And I lived north of Seattle, and I was commuting to Seattle working and then commuting back by carpool. So, of course, it takes a little bit longer. And, you know, so it takes up so much of your day. And then, of course, you have stuff to do afterwards, whether it's cooking or doing exercise or going to the grocery store, going to the bank, or, you know, just those daily activities that are so, that consume our everyday life. I think the nice thing about being here was that, we did have to slow down and it was much more relaxed. I get to really, I think, appreciate my husband more and appreciate the time I get to spend with my son and just the different people that surround us. I think it's been that part has been really nice for me to transition. It was hard to get used to at first because I was so bored just sitting around all day. What am I supposed to do? But now I've really come to appreciate it, that my life is a little bit slower and I can appreciate things and I can spend time, you know, praying and I can spend time in the Word and, you know, just kind of, enjoy the simple things in life instead of going too fast to really enjoy it.
So I love that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I find myself caught up in that American lifestyle of, you know, drop the kids off at school, go to work, pick the kids up, drive them to activity number one, drive them to activity number two, you know, and it just never stops. What do older kids here, like, is there, actually, when we were walking around earlier, like, there was a random field where probably 30 people were playing football. or playing soccer. Are there, like, organized activities for kids, or is that just, like, crazy? Is that
organized activities is not very normal here. So, like, they have school, obviously, and then, like, usually 3 days a week, there's extra school afterwards, and even sometimes on Saturdays, there's school. It's, like, extra tutoring and stuff for exams, but it's almost required to go, and so it kind of amazes me how much time kids spend in school, and they start school here around the age of three to four, so they start school a little bit younger than we do in the U.S., and but they spend an amazing amount of time. You know, it's not half days when they're
right.
three or four.
It's not
school days.
Enrichment after school. It's more kind of...
No, it's lectures. Really. Yeah. Like, it's very much pure education, not activity-wise. So they don't have a lot of that organized sports.
Okay.
It's mainly, oh, we're friends from the same neighborhood. You have a soccer ball. Let's go play.
Right.
They make their own fields in the middle of the roads. they will make a soccer ball out of anything. I've seen kids playing with milk here. They sell it in like half-liter plastic bags.
Okay.
And they only tear off the quarter, so it's easy to pour. And kids will take rubber bands and go around the hole, just make sure it's filled with air, and that's their football for the day. And
right.
so it's really amazing at how crafty some children can be at making a football here.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And it does, it just the two cultures in really stark comparison. I mean, I don't know that it could be a lot different in that regard, especially.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, that's something, a lot of times I'll talk with my friends about that, of just being like, how do you not have your kid in activities and then like be okay as far as like functioning in society,
yeah.
you know, like there's a lot of pressure
yeah.
for kids to do
yeah.
those things. And
yeah. And it, like the international schools, they definitely do some organized sports and that stuff because it's more expected.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, for a majority of the children here, they don't have that. It's, you have to be creative. And
yeah.
even when they're at home, they don't have a lot of extra things. So you know, even some children won't have television.
Mm-hmm.
So they really have to be a little bit more creative on how to entertain themselves.
Yeah, which is pretty beautiful, actually.
Yeah.
So before we talk about, I'd love to know a little bit more or a little bit about your job and the work that you do. Can you kind of talk about first just an average day, and then let's get into more specifics about the work that you do?
Yes, so I work for an international NGO. My average day, I work from 8 to 5. Normally going into the office, I'm a program writer, so I write proposals. So a lot of my day is email communications and writing, but then I also have a lot of meetings outside of work. So I'm going to different United Nations agencies, I'm going to different NGOs, different embassies, speaking with different donors that give money to kind of build relationships so that we can start working together.
Mm-hmm.
So probably have a meeting almost every day somewhere in the city. And then occasionally I'm required to travel into the field.
And what type of work does the organization do? What services do you provide?
Yeah, so I work for an organization called ZOA. It's based out of the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And we work with refugees and displaced people in 15 different countries. For me, I only work in Ethiopia. But we work in providing livelihoods, energy, water, shelter, education to the refugee camps, as well as working with the communities here who have had to leave their areas where they live, either because of natural disaster or because of conflict. And so we work with different communities throughout Ethiopia, providing the needs.
So where are people, where are the refugees from who end up in Ethiopia right now?
I mean, yeah, a majority of them, they come from three different places mainly. The largest population at this time is in Gambela, from South Sudan because of
okay.
the ongoing civil war
mm-hmm.
in South Sudan. There's also a large population of Somalis in eastern Ethiopia
mm-hmm.
because of, obviously, the prolonged issue in Somalia. So there's a couple different areas of camps there. And then in the north, there are refugees from Eritrea.
Okay. I just had a cab driver in San Diego who's from Eritrea. Yes. And he had an incredible story.
Most of them do. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, he came to the States when he was 14, I think, but like he left his family when he was like 6 or 7 years old and like made his own way. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, currently, I mean, I think most people have heard about the like refugee crisis in Europe.
Oh, yes.
And you hear about these thousands upon thousands of people crossing the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
And, a huge portion of those are Syrians, and you have a lot from the Middle East. But many that are coming from Africa are from Eritrea. And when we look at the refugee camps of Eritreans in the north of Ethiopia, a majority of them are unaccompanied minors.
Yes.
You will see young boys there as young as 5 without parents. And so the older boys who have come who are 14 or 15 are taking care of them, cooking for them when they really have no idea what they're doing. And so it's kind of amazing to see how these people are really getting along. So when you really start to look at the refugees and see their stories and see their backgrounds, sometimes you start to understand the crazy journeys that they take, the risks that they're taking because of what's really happening in their home countries that I think a lot of people don't necessarily understand. They just see, refugees, immigrants, they're coming into our country and they're taking over, but they don't necessarily see the person behind that.
Yeah. So you're seeing these situations playing out before you, and, you know, not to make light of your situation, but like you don't have internet very often.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, exactly.
But like you're coming from, you're a step much closer to this than most of our listeners would be. And you're looking at these situations, it sounds to me like with just a lot of compassion for these people. So what are some things, like what do we need to know about these conflicts in Eritrea or in South Sudan or Somalia? What do we need to know, and can we do anything to ease this sort of suffering? I mean, we believe very much on this podcast that like we belong to each other, you know, so what can we, sitting really in our comfy homes or cars in America, how do we respond to this?
Yeah, I think one of the things to remember is that they're people. You know, so often we hear, especially in politics nowadays and from people who are really against this, like that it's these hordes of people coming and they all want to, you know, somehow take over our country, whether it's, you know, religiously or through the economy or whatever. But I think we need to really, I don't know, think about the faces of these people, that these are people. You know, and they're not just inanimate objects, you know. And so I think if you want to do something about it, I think it's important to look up NGOs that work in these different countries, whatever country moves you, whether it's Syria. I mean, there are still NGOs that are working there, especially MSF, which in...
Doctors Without Borders.
Yeah, which in the U.S. we know is Doctors Without Borders. They're, you know, whether it's somewhere else in the Middle East, Northern Africa, really look into, like, what NGOs are working in those countries. And, I mean, you can give. There are nonprofit organizations in the U.S. That you can give and get tax deductions from those. And so I think, I think that's maybe a first step in how you can...
What do these refugee camps look like? I mean, if you could explain it to, you know, I think that's a really, it's nice, I think, to be able to even just see, like, oh my gosh, 14-year-olds are cooking for 5-year-olds. Like, that brings a level of compassion to my heart that I didn't have necessarily right before this conversation. So can you give us just more of a glimpse into these situations?
Yeah, obviously each refugee camp is different depending on when it was established and I think necessarily who's working there because, you know, some areas do shelter differently than others. But for the most part, I mean, Think of if you're going camping in the woods and you're living in a tent. Imagine that with a family of 10. That's what most of the refugee camps look like. They don't have resources, especially in Ethiopia. They have an encampment policy. So if you're a refugee, you're allowed in, but you have to stay in these camps. Mm-hmm. You're not allowed into normal society. So they can't have jobs, which means they can't make money. So they have no money to buy anything for their needs. UNHCR, which is the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, they do provide food, but just recently, like for the South Sudanese refugees, the finances for UNHCR have been less and less recently, and a lot of it has been rerouted for Syrian refugees. So their food rations that they get in the camps have recently been cut by 50%.
Wow.
But they're also not allowed to make any money. So that means you can't buy, they don't have stoves, so they have to cook over campfires, but you can't buy firewood. So you have to go outside to cut down wood, to collect wood, which then depletes the environment. And so it's this vicious cycle of, you know, of poverty and terrible conditions. And recently in Gambela with the South Sudanese refugees, there was major flooding. And so whatever you had, it was flooded. And many people had to move out of those areas. But there was a lot of then disease going on. So the conditions are, yeah, they're not kind.
Where do you see glimmers of hope? I know it's hard when you're working in this sort of field just to feel really tired of, you know? I mean, where do you find hope, do you think?
It does get a bit weighty sometimes. But one thing that I love about the organization that I work for, they're called ZOA, but they work on relief, hope, in recovery. And we, in Ethiopia, we really like to focus on the hope portion. We've heard stories from people that we've worked with, whether it's trying to build their livelihoods or give them training so that when they do find a place to settle, that they have something that they can do, that they have a skill. And we've heard from refugees that they're so thankful that we've been able to work with them because now they don't feel as desperate. They don't feel hopeless.
Yeah.
You know? They say that, you know, we've been given this hope to look into the future with brightness instead of seeing no future at all. And so, yeah, so you see it in the faces of refugees when you train them in some sort of skill, or you see it on the faces of people in Somali region of Ethiopia that are going through a horrific drought and you install a water pump for them. So you see it occasionally, and, but it really gives you the drive to continue because you know it matters.
Yeah. That's amazing. Oh my gosh, it's so amazing. All right. Well, we always like to ask our guests, especially mothers, we give all day, right? We're always taking care of our precious babies. You know, you're also in sort of this helping field. What do you do for you? Are there things that you can enjoy here in Ethiopia that just sort of fill up your soul? I know you mentioned earlier spending time in the Word and praying. Yeah. Like, are there things that really kind of fuel you so that you can be a great mom to Ezekiel and a great servant, really, in the work that you do?
Yeah, I think for me it's talking to people back home. I have such close relationships with friends and family back home that I haven't necessarily been able to fully get here because, you know, there's always cultural and language barriers. Mm-hmm. And so occasionally I get to be able to Skype and see the faces of my friends. And I think for me, that's really what encourages me is just being able to speak to someone that understands me, that knows I'm not in, you know, maybe the conditions that I was in the U.S., sure. but just being able to hear their voices and to hear their encouragement, it really motivates me to just keep going. Mm-hmm. You know, I can do it. And I think that is something that really uplifts me as well as relaxes me, that I'm not always stressed out or, you know, it's really nice just to be able to sit down and see the faces of some of my friends and their kids and just be able to, get encouragement from them, encouragement in the word as well. And, you know, being able to pray with them over Skype and stuff, it really just kind of gives me the strength to continue when I think there's maybe nothing left.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. This has been amazing. I mean, totally unexpected. We got into town late last night, and I just couldn't not interview you for this podcast. Cool. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you for thinking that my life is interesting enough to hear about.
Oh my gosh. Totally. I love it. Mama Bears, today we dare you to get curious and brave. Know that there are a million ways to parent your young ones and to give shape to your days. Open your eyes to what's surrounding you on this big blue planet of ours and pick up and grab what feels right. Soak up the enormity and the diversity of this world and let it excite you. Learn from one another. Be influenced in beautiful ways. No matter where you live, we dare you to breathe into a life that feels true to you. It might take you to the other end of the earth, or you might never leave your zip code that you were born in. No matter, we dare you to take the best parts of everything you experience, everything you read, everything you hear, and bring it into your home, letting it pulsate from your heart into your family and your one big, beautiful, and precious life.
I love it. So you guys, Mama Bears, remember, follow us on social media. We always put cool stuff there. Can I say that when we're the ones posting?
We think
it?
It's cool.
We
but
hope
we're
on
you too.
Yeah,
we think it's amazing.
We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat. So check us out there. We're at either Mama Bear Dares or Mama Bear Dares Podcast. Again, the show notes, mamabeardarespodcast.com. You can find everything there. And we are taking the show on the road. September 17th, we're going to be doing some really cool interviews in Chicago. We already have a really fun lineup, but we have room for a couple more. So if you know a few mama bears who you think deserve a slot, then hit us up. Hit us on the buzz. MamaBearDares@gmail.com is a great way to reach out there. Or, of course, send us a message on Facebook. And have we mentioned the bundle? The bundle. Have we mentioned the bundle you can win of Leslie's new book, Mama Bear's Manifesto? All you have to do is leave an iTunes review. That's it. We will announce that at some point when we stop being charmed by saying we're giving away a bundle.
And when we figure out what a bundle actually is. Once we figure that out, then we'll stop the contest and hopefully pick your name out of the hat.
That's right. But make sure you go there right now and leave one of those. But until then, you guys, have an awesome week. We will see you back here on Wednesday, where you'll hear a little bit about what we think about youth sports.
Mm-hmm.
She done did it. She did it.
Have a great week.